Chapter 10, and I am on my way. Toot toot, beep beep, honk honk. Well, this is nice. Like any normal man, I adore car horns, and pride myself on being able to recognise almost any vehicle currently using the British road network by its horn alone. Of course there are those who claim that manufacturers routinely reuse the same horn noise across multiple models. I happen to disagree with this, believing that each car horn is as unique and special as a human fingerprint or doggy's woof. And as I set off south along Ipswich Road, the automobiles of Norwich are in particularly fine voice. The pleasing tink-tink of a Ford Cougar, the playful doo-doo of a Fiat Punto, the throaty merp-merp of a lorry, although I wouldn't know which kind, as I don't do lorries. Yes, it's not hard to imagine how this harmless bit of fun could translate into a multi-territory early evening game show presented by Darren Day. OK, Alan, final round. Correctly identify the next horn, and you'll walk away with today's star prize, a tracker bar. It may be relevant to add at this point that I was becoming peckish and had a tracker bar in my bum's bag, or bum bag. Best of luck with this, Alan. Thanks, Darren. By the way, I thought you were excellent as HIV-positive gospel singer Gideon in the European premiere of the award-winning USA musical, The Last Session. But anyway, go ahead. Boop, boop. That's a Volvo S90. No, it was actually a Volvo S60. Well, Alan, you don't win the tracker bar, but it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and we hope to see you again one day. Oh, you will, Darren. You will. I own the format, mate. Everyone, give it up for Alan from Norwich. I take the tracker bar out of my bum bag and begin to eat it. It's my snack, and Darren Day can swivel if he thinks he can tell me when I can and cannot have it. Footnote. Thinking about it, I might replace him with Christine Bleakley. I like her. Tone down the accent a bit, and she could really become something. But as the tracker merges with the saliva in my mouth and turns back into porridge, I realise there's more to these car horns than meets the eye slash ear. These aren't just the everyday toots of a male driver assisting a female driver by pointing out that she was braking too early or pulling out without looking. These toots are aimed at me. I may have planned to slip out of town quietly, but it seems the drivers of Norwich have other ideas. They're giving me the car horn equivalent of a 21-gun salute, and I have to say, it warms the cockerels of my heart. People will say I'm being too complimentary, and there's no way they're this good, but I genuinely believe that if the people of Norwich were cheddar, they'd be Tesco finest cheddar. Full-flavoured and matured for 4 weeks, the keenly priced milk derivative has been winning the hearts, and I believe minds, of customers for the best part of a decade. Personally, it gives me heartburn and makes me feel like I might be sick any minute, but if you're after the market leader, look no further. With all eyes and horns on me, I wonder if this is what life is like for an international movie star or Samantha Fox. Footnote. For the benefit of overseas readers or those under 30, Sam Fox, full name Samantha Fox, was a topless model in the 80s, regularly posing for pages of the Sun newspaper, widely regarded as the most beautiful woman ever. Samantha also does a lot of work for charity. Her sexual preference is lesbian. But soon it becomes clear that the noise is more than just car horns. People are winding down their windows, eager to learn more about my quest. What are you up to, Alan? Where are you headed, Alan? Why are you walking in the fucking road, Alan? Admittedly, the last one is less well-meaning. It came from a white Ford Transit van with three men sitting in the front. As is customary, the one in the middle looks uncomfortable with the arrangement, but it's the driver who does the hollering. Not that I can quibble. With my eyes flicked to the closed position, I find I'm more hourly sensitive if I pretend to be congenitally blind. I've strayed onto the road. I avoid injury by diving to the pavement like a goalkeeper doing an ace soccer save, but I'm angry at myself. It's my belief that the roadway is for motorists. You wouldn't see a group of retired Hyundais trekking along the Pennine Way, or a Lexus hot and knackered on a treadmill, so why should a walker be permitted next to a major road? Don't get me wrong, I have no beef with walkers per se. In fact, as a driver, I take great pride in not having killed a single pedestrian in over 30 years behind the wheel. But as a form of transportation, you must be kidding me, pal. Walking's for the birds, not literally, apart from chickens and penguins. It's a relic of times gone by, like bowler hats or gallbladders. And while I do believe in preserving the traditions of the past, and I'm talking specifically here about Morris dancing, it must never be at the expense of road users. No, the only reason a person should be travelling on foot next to a carriageway is if their car has broken down, they're a sex worker, or they're walking in the footsteps of a close relative, such as a father. Yet they must do so with utmost care, and I failed in this duty. It's clear I need to apologise. I quickly jot down the van's registration number, although only in my mind because I don't have a pen. I'm pretty sure it's an S something O something something K. I vow to verbally do right by them when I'm back on North Norfolk Digital. Whoever these men are, whether work colleagues or, and this is just as likely, gay lovers with a shared interest in transit vans, I at least owe them this much. It's important for me to say thanks to each and every well-wisher, but I don't want people to think I'm fobbing them off with the same response each time. Fortunately, I'm a DJ, so words are my currency. The English language, and the French language to a far, far lesser degree, is like putty in my mouth. A single word soon becomes two, three, or even four. Thanks becomes tar, becomes thank you, becomes thank ye. Technically, thank ye is Elizabethan, but most people will understand it, with the possible exception of tradesmen, and those, if any, who deny the existence of history. But then there's intonation. Barely used by much of the population and deeply misunderstood by people like Lloyd Grossman, skillful intonation can have a dramatic effect on how well we communicate. Just as a kindly zoologist opening the sanctuary gates gives a rehabilitated herd of monkeys their freedom, so the emphasis placed on different words gives phrases to theirs. Take the phrase, thanks very much. There's not much you can do with that sentence, right? Wrong. Try repeating these after me. It's best if you sit upright and spit out any food that may be in your mouth. If you're on a bus or a train, it's important that you still take part in this. I've taken the time to create the demonstration, so if you don't participate, you're disrespecting me, and you have no class. Thanks very much. 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 How was that for you? You may be surprised at your reaction. Most likely your initial scepticism will have given way to a sense of awe as the true possibilities of the English language unfurl before your very eyes. Are you shaking a bit too? You might be. Yes, you are. Look, your hand, it's trembling. Take a while to sit under a tree, maybe switching off your phone and not going to work for a few days. Things will be different now. And while most monkeys die within 24 hours of entering the wild, that doesn't matter because I was only using it as a metaphor. So just relax and enjoy the liberation of intonation, or intonation, or intonation, or intonation, or intonation. Meanwhile, for those of you on crowded public transport who chose not to say the words aloud, you'll feel no different. And that's your own fault, because, as I say, you lack class and are assholes. By now it's mid-afternoon and I've reached the village of Swainsthorpe. Its only pub, the inexplicably named Sugarbeet, is sorely tempting me. A pint of bitter and a plate of crackers, please, but I've already fallen behind schedule and need to push on. The problem is my rucksack. Stuffed full of kit and protruding a clear foot above my head, it's like giving a piggyback to an unconscious teenager. In terms of pure weight, I've never carried anything even vaguely comparable. Once, after a few too many long iced teas at a BBC cocktail party, I promised to give Eamon Holmes a fireman's lift back to his car, but my knees buckled even before he'd climbed on. I claimed it was an old squash injury, but I think I was just scared. Footnote. Love you, Aim. Before I began my walk, my assistant said she'd been online and found out that not even the special forces carry packs as heavy as mine. Whether or not her internet research can be trusted is entirely another matter. This is, after all, the same woman I once caught raising her hand when she wanted to make a bid on an eBay auction. No, I would back my own judgment on this one. I don't dispute that the pack is big. It has a capacity of 100 litres, and although I have no intention of filling it with liquid, that gives you some idea of its size. The South African shop assistant had urged me in the strongest possible terms not to buy it, but I'd gone ahead anyway because I quote, I'm just that kind of guy. Besides, in a matter of days, I knew my body would grow accustomed to the weight. Bear Grylls once told me, and indeed anyone who watched that particular episode of his TV show, that experts believe we utilise only about 5% of the body's true capability. and while I know for a fact that he was confusing the word body with the word brain, he still had a point. We are capable of more than we think. Consider the pensioner who manages to complete the Flora London Marathon, albeit on a mobility scooter. The successful middle-aged singleton who sets up 3 Tinder dates in a single week, all with women who were either quite good-looking or very good-looking. Even the tiny ant, who can carry weight equivalent to a human lifting, at a guess, 60 skyscrapers. It's the end of day 1 of the Footsteps of My Father walk, and I've reached the village of Newton Flotman, some 8 miles from my starting point. I had hoped to get a few more miles under my belt, but I'm certain I'll soon make up any shortfall. Speaking of my belt, I notice it's incredibly sweaty under there. Some of the sweat, and I suspect it's the stuff I emitted early in the day, has solidified into a kind of black dough, flecks of which are dotted around my midriff. Yet, no matter how great the temptation, and I reassure myself that it's perfectly normal to have these thoughts, there's no way I'm going to eat any of it. My first task is to make camp. I've been looking forward to this because my new tent is an absolute stunner, or stonker, as Lenny Henry would say. It cost me £699.99, and is designed to withstand the kind of gusts you only find in the Arctic. The South African shop assistant said it was overkill for a trek in the UK, but I'd gone ahead anyway because I'm just that kind of guy. Footnote. And I also thought he was saying attic rather than Arctic. Like I say, he was South African. But there's a snag. The tent is at the bottom of my state-of-the-art rucksack. When drawing up the list of items to pack, I cleverly arranged things in order where they should be placed. The first on the list represented the item at the top of the bag, the last thing on the list the item at the bottom. Yet when my assistant came to do the packing, well, you can guess the rest. Hapless doesn't even begin to cover it. Why she would think that the first item on the list should be packed first, I have no idea. Who packs like that? Much like her belief in the Bible and her insistence on never allowing her petrol tank to become less than half full, it simply defies all reason. I estimate that it will take me somewhere between 12 and 15 minutes to unpack the bag and retrieve the tent, and there's no way that's going to happen. I'm just not that kind of guy. And then I had a brainwave. Scrolling through my mental Rolodex, I came to a stop at the name of one Tony Cloak. Tony and I go way back and had been friends until as recently as the 8th of June 2013. In a handy twist of fate, Tony lives right here in Newton Flotman because he can't afford to buy in Norwich. I shall borrow a tent from him. Knock, knock, knock. This is me rapping on Tony's front door. The custom when arriving at someone's house is to knock twice, and I'm well aware of this, but I need help, and by adding a third knock, I've immediately made my presence more interesting. Ooh, Tony will be thinking, 3 knocks instead of the traditional 2. Who could this be? I'm already feeling more inclined to help them out, unless it's the Jehovah's, in which case they can fuck off. Footnote. I'm afraid Tony's language can be quite fruity at times. The door opens, or rather Tony opens it. It's not automatic or anything. He's more overweight than I remember, but has quite a lot more hair. He looks me up and down, then up again, so he's back on my face. Alan? Hello, Tony. Long time no text. You still owe me 3 grand, you prick. Full disclosure. In June 2013, I accidentally rear-ended Tony. Just to be clear, I mean rear-ended Tony's car. Just to be even more clear, I mean my car rear-ended Tony's car. Tony claimed it was my fault, but I believe it was his. The lights had gone green, so technically, perhaps even legally, he should have pulled away. But did he? No, because he was too busy picking food out of his teeth. With his lower front incisors huddled together like cows under a tree, stuck food was a recurring problem for Tony. Whether or not the issue played a role in the collapse of his first marriage is a moot point, but if your husband is a man who can't eat a sandwich without his front teeth ending up looking like they're wearing gloves made of chewed bread, then it's bound to cause friction. Long story short, he and I had drifted apart after the incident, but he's a good man, and I feel sure he'll see past all this to help out a friend in need. Listen, Tone, forget about the car smash. I need to borrow a tent. Sure. I've condensed our conversation to cut out the bits that aren't relevant, but in brief, we restated our positions vis-à-vis the accident. He grabbed me by the throat, I smashed him in the balls, he tried to roundhouse me but couldn't, he's 56. We realised this was stupid, hugged again, did high fives, hugged again, cup of tea, slice of cake, borrowed tent, hugged for the road, walked away. I clamber over a low fence and onto a bowling green. I've always had a soft spot for these places. I went through a period in the 80s of having crown green bowls related daydreams. I'd imagine myself as a bowling ball. I'd roll along the grass, round and round, round and round, until, with a gentle clack, I'd bump into a smaller white ball. "Hello," I'd say, "I'm black." "Hello," the white ball would reply, "I'm white." Then in unison we'd say, "And that's just fine." At the time I'd been listening to Ebony and Ivory a lot, a lot. So I guess the racial harmony thing had something to do with that. Why I'd been dreaming about crown green bowls, however, is less clear. With a heavy heart comes the knowledge that I'm going to have to hammer my tent pegs into the hallowed turf. I'm aware this will cause significant damage, but I'm too tired to look for anywhere else. And also, I once read an article in the Mail on Sunday that said bumpy mattresses can cause sciatica. As I remove the canvas house from its bag, I realize that it's seriously large, at least a six-berther. Tony doesn't even have kids, so there's no reason for him to need a tent this size. It's all a bit look at me. And while we all like to act the big man on a campsite, this is just silly. The obvious explanation would be that Tony bought the tent as part of his attempt to woo the woman who would later become his second wife. It was a classic piece of dick swinging. I begin to think about the kinds of things the two of them must have got up to in it. For a while it's immensely enjoyable, but when I imagine Tony rolling over and catch a glimpse of him front on, I don't like it any more, and I ask my mind to make it go away. Darkness has now fallen, and I set about the business of becoming erect. Strictly speaking, it takes more than a single person to put up a tent of this scale. But I'm not going to let that stop me. Not that it's easy, mind you. The tent is a stubborn old bugger. When I put the front up, the back falls down. When I put the left up, the right falls down. I'm reminded of that impossible staircase in the famous sketch by Etcher. After 4 hours of trying, I nearly said crying then, which I did do, actually, I quickly reach the conclusion that this isn't going to work. But as I manhandle the tent back into its bag, I stumble over something else. Hidden at the bottom is another tent, and it's a ruddy one-manner. Under my breath, I've been saying some pretty rotten things about Tony. They were just born of tiredness and hunger. Of course I don't want him to step on a landmine, but suddenly all is forgiven. With a renewed sense of purpose, I set to work. Within minutes, I am under canvas and, to quote Act 4, Scene 3 of Henry V, a bed. It's only when I attempt to zip the door shut that it dawns on me that this is a tent for a child. I had seen the picture of Buzz Lightyear on the outer wall, but had chosen not to leap to conclusions. The Toy Story franchise can be enjoyed by people of all ages. But now I am inside it, the truth cannot be denied. I am in the sleeping vessel of a child. Tucking my knees to my chest, I close my eyes and get some shut-eye. Or open mouth, as my wife used to call it, because I sleep with my mouth agape and my tongue ululating slightly.